Mr. Hearst, Chairman, Vice Chairman of the Board of Trustees, members of the faculty and student body and staff, and other servants of the Lord Jesus Christ, it is my great privilege to respond to the invitation of the faculty to deliver this Founders Day address as I complete 2 decades as president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. This will not be a traditional Founders Day address, for it will not focus on the founders, but on what we of the seminary community in the 1950s and 1960s have done with, and I'm afraid also to, that heritage. It provides me an occasion to record my perspective on some things that have happened. This involves the telling of certain stories, and that in itself is somewhat dangerous, lest you determine that I'm in my anecdotage. The arithmetic of 20 years out of the 112-year history of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary produces the, to me, unbelievable fact that I have served as president of this institution for 1/6 of its history. Fortunately, its direction is a shared responsibility involving colleagues of the faculty, the staff, the Board of Trustees, the Southern Baptist Convention, and more recently, the students. In retrospect, I'm aware that a great deal of my attention and effort has been focused on defining and relating the role of each of these elements to the end that together we would serve as a unified instrument of the purpose of God. The goal is to change the world in the name of Jesus Christ by the proclamation of the gospel through word and deed. This has involved a precarious balancing act requiring the shifting of one's weight, sometimes right, sometimes left, sometimes forward, then backward. I confess to a perverse pride in having been contradictorily labeled at different times during these years as an integrationist deserving of the expenditure of considerable money and energy by certain white citizens' councils, and in other quarters as a segregationist whose love for his native Mississippi is clear. Another set of labels has been various versions of totalitarian administrator versus permissive presider over an undisciplined community. Still another set of descriptions used at different times is an organizational man and denominational loyalist versus an ecumenicist. Perhaps the pair of labels most often used is theological liberal versus, quote, the leader of biblical fundamentalism in the Southern Baptist Convention, unquote. Candidly, I am always stung by the labels, but enjoy the fact that the balancing act of the president of so complex an enterprise as the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary eventually evokes contradictory categories. Like most administrators, and I'm not claiming very much here, my self-image defines my commitments and goals much nearer the middle. I would borrow from my friend and fellow academic administrator for half of these 2 decades, Dr. C. Penrose Santamore, his definition of school administration as, quote, the art of the possible, unquote. The ideal of the seminary as a Christian community operating with intellectual integrity by democratic means to exhibit zealously and perfectly the mind of Christ in a marred and wicked world is not yet a reality. That may come to you as news. When I became pastor of the Broadway Baptist Church of Louisville in 1940, I intended to spend my life in the pastorate. When I became president of the New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary in 1943, I knew I'd found my destiny. When I was conscripted as executive secretary of the Southern Baptist Convention Executive Committee in 1946, I promised myself and planned to leave in 5 years because that powerful and important position made me feel too far from the forming of the ministry. Even so, had I been omniscient and omnipotent, I would not have planned to become president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary until 1970. That would have avoided almost 20 years of mistakes, or else enabled me to blame them on somebody else. I could not have come to the seminary. I could have, in 1970, come to the seminary with an able and mature faculty which would, for the most part, outlive me, and thereby I could avoid responsibility for participating in faculty selection and also avoid the turmoil of a young faculty testing its wings. My point is not that I regret the last 20 years. I would just rather have more of it ahead than behind. Well, I knew it was a mistake to become president of Southern Seminary back in 1951. In 1950, while executive secretary for the Southern Baptist Convention, I went to West Africa for the centennial celebration of the Nigerian Baptist Convention. Southern Seminary President Ellis Fuller was to be there and speak at the commencement of the Nigerian Baptist Seminary. Illness prevented his going, so I took his place on that commencement program. I record that not because it is important to you, but it is to me. I had planned that fall to travel as roommate of Dr. Fuller on a preaching mission to Japan. The mission included 15 American preachers. Unfortunately, the Korean War canceled westward traffic across the Pacific, so Dr. W.A. Criswell and I were the only two, other than the Foreign Mission Board staff members, who were able to get to Japan. We got there on a commission from the Foreign Mission Board to travel eastward from Nigeria to investigate the possibility of visas for Southern Baptist missionaries in Turkey, Pakistan, India, and Indonesia. Thus, Dr. Criswell, popular pastor of the First Baptist Church of Dallas, was my roommate instead of Seminary President Fuller. On the last day of the preaching mission, I received in Tokyo a cablegram telling me of the untimely death of Ellis Fuller, Prince of Preachers, fundraiser and builder extraordinary, who by the grace of God had served 8 years as president of this institution, guiding it through World War II and the explosive post-war years. Within a few months, strong advocates of Dr. Herschel Hobbs for president of Southern Seminary arose. And I interrupt myself to say I'm going to use names through what I say because without them, the account would have little meaning to many of you who are here. Dr. Hobbs was not sure he should permit his friends to press the matter. Assuming that the executive secretary of the executive committee of the convention knew something about the situation in each Baptist agency, Dr. Hobbs used our strong personal friendship to test the water. It happened that while traveling with Dr. Ellis Fuller to a Baptist World Alliance executive meeting in London in 1948, I had listened for hours on the deck of the old Queen Elizabeth to his agonized review of the tension between young faculty members and the administration, his struggle to chart a course for the seminary when old landmarks were being pulled up by the root and old styles of life challenged and abandoned. My response, therefore, to Dr. Hobbs in 1951 was, and this is a direct quote, "Only a fool would accept the presidency of Southern Seminary at this time." A few months later, while attending the Southern Baptist Convention in San Francisco, Dr. H.I. Hester, then chairman of the committee to nominate a new president for Southern Seminary, asked me to meet with the committee. I was not much interested in the subject and had some responsibilities in the convention session as an excuse, so I just missed the appointment. My conscience bothered me about my manners, so when driving home with my family through Kansas City, Missouri, I called Dr. Hester at Liberty and apologized for not meeting with the nominating committee. Perhaps there was more than bad conscience in that apology. At any rate, Dr. Hester read it that way, with the result that on July 17, 1951, with great concern on the part of all for secrecy, I met with the nominating committee in the Farragut Hotel in Knoxville, Tennessee. I sensed that the committee was more than a little annoyed that I insisted I would consider the presidency only on the basis of a genuinely enthusiastic and unanimous vote of the trustees and of the faculty. The proposal seemed safe enough to me because I knew... You beat me to the draw. Because I knew that the faculty was badly divided with, among other groups, a strong faction under the leadership of Dr. J.B. Wetherspoon, desiring Dr. M. Theron Rankin, Executive Secretary of the Foreign Mission Board, as president. I was surprised when, on the basis of the Knoxville Conference, the committee called a meeting of the full Board of Trustees in Louisville, August 1, 1951, and then asked that I come to Louisville to discuss with them the presidency on the basis of unanimous election by the Board of Trustees. I came by Louisville en route to participating in the program of the Foreign Mission Conference at Ridgecrest. Having assured my wife that nothing was at stake except a detour by way of Louisville. I've needed to say this publicly in front of her several times since then. The trustee officers were clearly apprehensive when I insisted that the faculty not only had to be unanimous, but had to tell me so in private conference. I met that afternoon with all the members of the faculty who were in Louisville in the lounge of Faculty Center. The fact that each man present told me in his own words why he felt I was God's man for the job convinced me that something approaching a miracle had taken place. It wasn't really a miracle, it would have stuck. That evening, while meeting with the executive committee of the trustees at the Penn Dennis Club, I announced that on two conditions I would accept the presidency. The first was that I would not have to live in the Norton Estate, and I did not get the other one either. The seminary public relations office released the news of my acceptance while I was still in the conference, so that my wife received the word of the action from a newspaper reporter. I apologize again. The responses to the news story included an affectionate, supportive letter from Dr. Herschel Hobbs. However, remembering my advice to him, he began his letter, "Dear Fool." I still prize that letter. 7 years later, when the situation finally blew apart, I wrote out a wire to Dr. Hobbs, which read simply, quote, "I was right," signed, "The Fool." The point of this anecdote is not simply to support my contention that it would have been wiser to wait to become president until 1970, but also to underscore the whole issue of faculty participation in the decision-making process of the seminary. Because of events at the close of the administration of President John R. Sampey, The trustees, in electing Ellis Fuller as president in 1942, turned away from the primus inter pares principle to define the president not as first among equals, but rather as the chief administrator of the institution. This cucklebur under the saddle, though in no wise his responsibility, created difficult problems for President Fuller. To my surprise, the concept of the equality of the faculty members in the administration of the institution had shifted in my first years from the president to the permanent departmental chairman. Some of you brethren may remember this. This provides evidence that the faculty position was rooted in a principle and not against any person. When I finally despaired of a democratically arrived at solution to the problem of the departmental chairman, I used the president's trustee-given power to announce that the problem was settled. No department chairman would be removed except by his death or resignation, and no vacancies would be filled because the president would not nominate anyone for them. The older faculty members approved of the first part of the decision, and the younger faculty members approved of the latter part, so we settled down to live happily ever after. Of course, ever after, even in fairy tales, means through the honeymoon. The most urgent problems of the seminary in 1951 was the housing of married students. The institution had exploded in size, had become full of married men. Couples lived in Manly Hall without kitchen facilities and with bathroom facilities on alternate floors. Landlords were gouging students with $100 a month rent for cold water apartments. I remember the longing with which my wife and I, as students ourselves, had watched the building of the Green Tree Manor Apartments on Fenley Avenue, renamed Seminary Village. I searched out the owner and finally met him in the Tampa Terrace Hotel in Florida. He refused even to discuss price with me. I returned to Louisville and asked Trustee Farris Sampson, who had been a troubleshooter for the Norton family, to go over to Charlotte, North Carolina, where Mr. Lloyd Good lived, and see if he could pry loose the Green Tree Manor Corporation from him. Mr. Sampson failed as I had, but as he left Mr. Good's office, he asked for direction to the First Baptist Church to visit the pastor, former trustee, seminary trustee, Caspar Waring. Mr. Good offered to take him by. They went in the wrong door, and passing through the sanctuary, Mr. Good said, they have moved the baptistry. Mr. Sampson asked how he knew. The reply was, I was baptized in it when it was over there. Upon Mr. Sampson's return to Louisville, he made his report a failure, but added to it the baptistry incident. Now, I had sought from every possible source to know about Mr. Good and had all sorts of information, but no one, friend or professional investigator, had associated him with any church or religious conviction. Even so, the lights flashed and the bell began to ring, which is my description of what happens when I have an idea. I called Mr. Good and insisted that he come to Louisville. I told him that I had made a mistake. I was trying to buy the Green Tree Manor Corporation from him, when as a former Baptist, I should have been trying to sell him on the importance of Southern Seminary. Besides, I added, there are four things I want, two for you and two for me. First, I want the Green Tree Manor Corporation. Second, I want a friend for Southern Seminary. Third, I want you to make a little money. Fourth, I want you to recapture your experience with Jesus Christ as Savior and Lord. He laughed at this ridiculous approach, but did agree to come. He arrived in time for chapel, which in those good days was jammed with students. Whose congregational singing was always a thrilling experience. We went to the Pendennis Club for lunch and a meeting with the Seminary Financial Board. There he found seminary trustees who moved in his own business league. unexpectedly, he agreed to the seminary's offer, whereupon the seminary's lawyers began to backpedal, saying, "We have not yet had an examination of the title or an audit of the assets of the corporation." Mr. Goode looked at me, and seeing my disappointment over this response, broke into laughter. He pulled out of his briefcase the stock certificate for all the shares of stock in the Green Tree Manor Corporation, and turning it over, endorsed it to the seminary and flipped it across the table to me. With that, he said, "You own Green Tree Manor Corporation." He returned to Charlotte without so much as a receipt for the 26 acres and 26 buildings, including 265 apartments. He joined the St. John's Baptist Church of Charlotte and continued as a member there until his death. All four of the things for which I prayed were realized. Today, I hope we are on the way to the sale and replacement of Seminary Village with a miracle about twice that size to avoid disturbing students in the village and avoid large rent increases while improving student housing. I'm convinced that the education of seminary students is not limited to the classroom, but includes the place they live, the chapel, the cafeteria, heaven forbid, the place they work, and all the people they come to know. In 1953, I made some effort to involve the students in the administration of the seminary through student government, patterned after the Southern Baptist Convention. Didn't work for the students either. How times do change. A seminary community which used to struggle over the proper balance of responsibility between the faculty and the administration is currently caught up in the process of determining student responsibilities in not only administrative decisions, but also academic decisions. No wonder that the trustees, who have lived through one major explosion that resulted from the handling of the balance of responsibility between faculty and president, are hearing alarm bells as they contemplate this new shift in the balance of power. Perhaps it would be instructive, though the subject remains somewhat tender, for me to recount what I think took place in 1958, when contradictory views of the role of faculty and administrative officers collided. Let me underscore the fact that this is an interpretative rather than a complete account of events. Like other organizations which beat their drums about democratic procedures without the use of checks and balances to assure them, Southern Seminary was, in fact, an operation usually revolving around the president's office. It's not in the manuscript, and I'm not going to put it there, but E.Y. Mullins' nickname in the faculty, which is not recorded, was Pope. During the administration of Dr. Fuller, the seminary grew in size and complexity to be an institution of 1,103 students and 39 faculty members. This development accelerated during my first 5 years, so that in 1956, the seminary had become three schools, 1,767 students, and 68 faculty members. Every decision, academic, buildings and grounds, or financial, revolved around the president. The point is not that the president always got his way, but that no decision could be made without his involvement. The presidential overload was obvious to all. So with faculty and trustee concurrence, we turned to an outside management consultant firm of Booz Allen and Hamilton for a study of the seminary and recommendations about its structure. The study was authorized May 23, 1956, and the report was submitted January 24, 1957. Having dealt with this same consultant firm and with other consultant firms on numerous occasions in the last two decades, I am still of the opinion that this report was one of the best analyses and prescriptions to come out of such a study. It was presented by the consultants to both the faculty and the trustees, and was apparently accepted with enthusiasm, but probably without full comprehension. It envisaged a revolutionary reorganization of the seminary, transferring presidential responsibilities to the deans and business manager, removing the president as presiding officer of the trustee executive committee, enlarging the executive committee, and establishing guidelines and benchmarks for salary scales and so on. The most important personnel decision was to replace the president as dean of the School of Theology. It is doubtful that either the president or the faculty was ready for the decision, but they approached the task with zest. Dr. Olin Binkley, now president of Southeastern Seminary, was the unanimous choice of both the faculty and the president. He declined to let his name be presented to the trustees. Chafing under the overload, which had become more acute by virtue of the many changes required by the Booz Allen and Hamilton report, the president sought both personal relief and also to establish the new office of the Dean of the School of Theology by recommending that Professor Henley Barnett serve as acting dean. He was elected May 30, 1956, and began his duties August 1st of that year. There is a footnote here, which I shall omit, that records my disappointment in some agreements with reference to the financing of the proposed new seminary library in the centennial year 1959. The agreement just didn't hold together. The 1958 allocation to Southern Seminary for capital needs from the Southern Baptist Convention Cooperative Program was zero, and frantic efforts with all stops pulled out finally changed zero in 1959 to a mere $150,000. The point of this footnote is a kind of alibi in which I am frankly saying that the president's energies were diverted from the internal restructuring to fundraising. There is no question but that the president became overly weary as he scrounged for the needed $1.5 million. At the same time, the faculty became insecure as old procedures disappeared and new organizational structures with new people took over. The rapid growth in faculty size had reduced some elements of the sort of congeniality which had existed. Wretchedly low salaries made every family uncomfortable. A scapegoat for frustration was needed. Meanwhile, the search for a school dean went on. The focus of the search was outside of the seminary community, but the president began to canvass the faculty members as prospective deans. Immediately, he thought of Dr. William Morton, one of his closest friends, but after careful evaluation, rejected that choice and centered on Dr. Morris Ashcraft, a younger colleague of Dr. Morton in the Department of Biblical Archaeology. Thereupon, the president sat down with Dr. Morton first to predict that the faculty would think of Dr. Morton as dean, and second, to tell Dr. Morton that the president did not want him to be dean, and third, to ask Dr. Morton's evaluation of Dr. Ashcraft as a possible dean. The president's offer to explain his strong objection to Dr. Morton as dean was brushed aside as obvious. A few weeks after this conversation, a faculty member proposed Dr. Morton for the position, and an overwhelming majority of the faculty concurred. The president expected Dr. Morton to withdraw his name, whereas Dr. Morton later said he would have done so had the president requested it. For want of a nail, a shoe was lost. Feeling that he was forced to take a public position and sensing that Dr. Ashcraft would not permit his name to be entered over against that of his senior colleague, the president turned to his alternate choice, Dr. Cornell Gorner, professor of missions. No worse decision could possibly have been made because, unknown to the president,
Dr. Gorner had been in touch with the Foreign Mission Board and had been asked to be secretary for Africa. The 1971 Founders Day address by Duke K. McCall continues on side two of this tape.
Which defined his role made him responsible for nominating a dean of his choosing acceptable to the faculty. The substantive issue was Tweedledee and Tweedledum, but it served as a catalyst for all of the tensions that resulted from President Sampey's retiring recommendation adopted by the trustees in May 1943. making the president the chief executive officer of the institution. Hopes that the trustee meeting of March 1958 would resolve the problem were soon dashed, as shortly thereafter the debate turned from administrative policy and procedures to irrational personal and theological charges. Good men on both sides were badly injured and wronged by events. The division was not between angels and devils, although a high degree of the demonic appears to have been turned loose throughout the life of the institution. There is, however, an instructive development not heretofore made public. 13 faculty members had been dismissed on June 12, 1958, by a trustee vote of 32-9. Yet no one thought that the matter had been settled. I wrote out an undated resignation as president of the seminary and put it in the hands of Dr. Lamar Jackson, chairman of the Board of Trustees. On a Monday morning late in June, Dr. Morris Ashcraft came to my office to say, in effect, "I have spent the weekend reviewing what has occurred, and I have concluded that a historian who really knew all of the events would not feel that either side has been as fully Christian as the world has a right to expect of us." I agreed. I tried to communicate to him my regret and grief and my deep desire that he should return to the seminary faculty. He asked if I would say the same thing to any of the other professors who had been dismissed. I assured him that I would. Out of this came a written agreement prepared by certain of the dismissed faculty members, which contemplated a reversal of the trustee action. I agreed to be party to the document and present it to the trustee executive committee with the understanding that representative faculty members would be called into the meeting. I went to that trustee committee meeting, July 1, 1958, with a happy heart, naively supposing the trustees would vote unanimously to approve the document, sing the doxology, and call for the beloved brethren to join us in a celebration. It was at this point that I learned one of the harshest lessons of 20 years as president of this institution. Certain faculty members, the Board of Trustees, and the administration had been on the same side of the controversy, but as it developed, for quite different reasons. Despite my pleading at such length, the trustee V.V. Cook Sr. accused me of filibustering. The trustee executive committee unanimously rejected the compromise document by reaffirming the previous action of the full board. The executive committee was willing for certain of the faculty members to return, but only on the basis of a procedure devised by the Board of Trustees in connection with its June dismissal action. To reconcile individuals who have a basic Christian commitment is not too difficult. To reconcile groups of individuals after structured conflict has begun is next to impossible. There are available numerous sociological and psychological analyses of group conflict. The recital here is designed simply to underscore the utter immorality of any one of us, and I'm talking about myself, of any one of us submerging his conscience in group relations to the point that he loses his sense of responsibility to be a lone and a lonely agent of reconciliation as needed. The further lesson is that written documents, no matter how official, never substitute for koinonia. But Christian koinonia must grow in the hostile environment of pride and greed and human imperfections, or it will never grow at all. The basic relation in a Christian institution is never between staff members, professors, deans, presidents, students, trustees. Rather, it is always in terms of an individual sense of being Christian brother to another individual. That is where koinonia begins, if it is to exist. We can only create the environment for Christian koinonia in this institution or anywhere else if we begin with a solid, basic assumption that, quote, we be brethren, unquote. And then listen and look for evidences on the other's part of that sense of Christian brotherhood. Well, we shall need something more than ourselves. Often I have welcomed students to the seminary saying, if God has called you into his ministry, the seminary can help you become a more effective minister. But if God has not called you into his ministry, we have no power to make you a minister at all. The function of the seminary is to take those who have made such a commitment to the Christian ministry as they are and enlarge their understanding, discipline them in intellectual integrity, and nurture their spiritual growth. In attempting to do this, the seminary in these 20 years has passed through many revisions of the curriculum, changing degree structures and school organization. We have watched chapel attendance rise and fall, hair grow long, and skirts grow short. The styles change. The perversities of human nature remain. The truth of the biblical revelation continues to have transforming power. The promise of God's presence with wisdom and power can still be claimed, and miracles may be wrought as the loving God reaches through your life to a lost world. We are in an era when we are called again to outlive, outthink, and outlove the world. Let us begin by making the world say of us what it said of Christians long ago. Behold how they loved one another. Then, in Christ's name, let us go out to serve our fellow man.